I am very pleased right now to be able to present to you Mrs. Romney.
Honored guests at the speaker's table and dear friends, I was delighted with my introduction. I was at a meeting not long ago when the young lady introduced me and she said, every time I see Mrs. Romney, she looks entirely different. The last time I saw her, she looked quite nice. But every time I see you, you look wonderful. I've been here, I think, since the inception, isn't that right? Dear Brake? And it's been a great uplift for me. In fact, I've quoted some of you all over the country, things that were said, questions that were asked. And I feel that the young people today are more honest, more inquisitive, more idealistic, and more prepared than probably young people at any other age in our history. As a matter of fact, we've almost reached the dreams and the goals that we were striving for years ago, education for all, opportunity for all, ascendant brotherhood and humanity. And yet at the same time, we're at a, well, at the crossroads, you might say, on a razor edge where we can go into an abyss of violence, tyranny, immorality, disbelief. And so it makes this age extremely critical and extremely exciting because your lives and what you do with them may determine the fate not only of your community, your state, your nation, but the whole world. And if that sounds dramatic, remember that Father Bruckberger said in his Image of America, and Father Bruckberger is one of the finest historians we have today, he said, America, do what you have to do and do it quickly, or the whole world is lost. More recently, philosophers have said that unless we can prove that our society is above the competing and conflicting societies of the world, that the struggle is of no avail. So if you take these things seriously, you realize that we are on the razor edge of some very fateful decisions, and that one of the things that is going to determine what happens to us and our generation is going to be the quality of our own lives. And it's going to be determined by the environment of modern man and what that environment is. I've been upset as I've read about all the attitudes of some of our leaders in labor, in management, in politics, in any field you want to go into. You will find that there is a growing cynicism and taking matters into their own hands. Social workers believe that they can give you the standards that are going to be right for your lives. There is a growing belief that everything rests upon the mind of man. And I want to talk about this for a minute because I believe that although we have changed our world technologically, scientifically, although everything is very new as far as flying men into space and whirling and putting in Telstar in the heavens, everything that is very beautiful and that makes life worth living is very old. And therefore, you can't say that because things are changing and men have made such great strides, that men know about the human and social affairs and the conduct in an expert way so that they can tell you how to live and how to mold your lives. They can help you, but open your souls to the wisdom of the past. Understand something about what has made relationships beautiful and ages great before. Know something about quality in the lives of people today. Don't just rely upon the precepts of men. And I'd like to maybe make my remarks in three areas. First, I'd like to talk for a minute about your physical selves. And let me say that every choice you make is going to affect you one way or another. One of the wonderful things about a democracy is that you can choose your way of life, where you're going to live, what your vocation's going to be, the type of homes, relationships you're going to have, but you cannot change the results of those decisions. They are each going to have consequences. And so as you make those decisions, you are going to be guided and ruled by them. It's important that we have knowledge, but how we use that knowledge determines our very society, where we live, what comforts we have, what is important, what our values are, what our goals are, and, as I say, the very quality of our own lives and society. And this starts with the physical person. I think few of us realize how magnificent a human body is. I was in a hospital recently when I saw so many that were stricken. If you've been torn apart, there was one woman who had been shot in the abdomen. Her liver had been destroyed and shattered. We don't realize that the liver changes the things that we eat into chemicals so that they can be absorbed by the tissues of our body, into protein, into starches, into the various components that make us what we are. We don't realize that when we get nutrients through our veins, that although they are life-giving nutrients, that they're not going to be important to us unless we absorb them, unless our tissues drink them up, unless they utilize them and they become part of our very being. These bodies we can mutilate, we can abuse, but we can't bring them back to their excellence as they once were, no matter how hard we try. The doctor that stitched the liver and tried to bring it back couldn't make it as fine as it was to begin with. Those that put fine ingredients into the veins couldn't bring the nutrients to the body that were originally there before degeneration set in. We have to realize that this body that we have, that you have now, is in its most excellent stage and state. And so what you decide to do with it is going to determine how well you breathe, your stamina, the quality of your heart and lungs, the respiratory system, how well your mind and brain functions, how much you're going to enjoy hiking and dancing and skiing and all the other things. And if someone forced you to put poison into your bodies that would keep you from breathing well and your circulatory system from being at top peak, you would remonstrate with all of your strength. But because ads are attractive, because you are made to believe that if you are going to be glamorous and if you're going to be popular, if you're going to be mature, if you're going to drink in the wonderful fresh air of the country, you take in ingredients that destroy part of you, we feel that it's smart and grown up to do it. And let me just ask you, who wants you to take these poisons into your body? Those who care about you and your future, or those who care about their own pocketbook? And when you realize that those who would enhance their own riches are those who make the ads the most attractive, you must weigh for yourself whether you are going to succumb. And you know, the good book tells us that men crept in, ungodly men, and to beware of them because they would turn the grace of God into licentiousness. Remember that there are those who will creep in that will use magnificence for their own gains and to destroy you. When you think about drugs of all kinds, remember that there are experiences to be gained, feelings to be known, that are far beyond anything that any drug can give you if you keep your senses from being impaired. And those who would have you think that it's exciting to go on a trip, as they call it, or to have a dream with marijuana, remember those are false things, that they're not real, and that you can experience the magnificence of something real and exciting, that you can be part of this age that is human and social and that can lift mankind through your policy and action and understanding, and that you have an opportunity today that's probably more exciting and more has a greater magnitude than has ever been possible before. And so as you choose what you're going to take into your body, remember that body is to serve you for the rest of your life. And if this seems to you ageless now, it isn't. Before you know it, you're going to find that the degenerative processes have started to take place. And you'll wish that while you had your strength, you had preserved it. I don't want to go on to it too long, but I do want you to know that each part of you is related. You can't say, as the good book again says, the eye can't say to the hand, I have no need of thee, or to the foot, I have no need of thee. You need every part that you have. I broke my shoulder a few months ago. And I had no idea how wonderful that shoulder joint is. You know, you can push it upwards and forwards and around and back. I can do everything fine with my left one. My right isn't quite what it should be yet. But I realized that all the strength of my right arm and my hand came from that shoulder. I realized I couldn't swim, I couldn't hang on, I couldn't do any of the things that I was used to doing. I couldn't even comb my hair or dress correctly. Fortunately, I had an understanding husband who could help me. But the point is that you don't appreciate this. You just take a shoulder, you take everything for granted until it's damaged. And people who have destroyed their lungs, their health, tell me that this is the way it was with them. And yet some get hooked, and then they can't change. I heard of a young boy whose father's high up in government, that they tell me he is hooked now so to drugs that he cannot stop. What kind of a life? So before you make some decision, stop and think about the results. Then about your intellectual selves. There will never be another time in your lives when you will be free to take into your minds literature, religion, biology, history, music, everything that is open to you from the libraries from the past to the same extent that there is today, because you have no other real responsibilities. You don't have the responsibilities of making a living, of family, of the community, of government, all the things that come on you in your maturity and which are important. Need you to be prepared at this stage and need you to pour into yourselves all the information you can get so that you can be excellent in your knowledge. Even a doctor who has quite a few skills is not important to you if he isn't the finest as a diagnostician, if he doesn't know how to prescribe, if he isn't able to help you in an efficient way. A plumber, no matter how skilled he may think he is, if he comes in and can't fix your damaged pipes, whatever you have, is of no use to you. Whatever you do should be done with excellence, and it can't be unless you have prepared yourself. Oh, I could tell you some interesting experiences. I don't want to take too much time with my husband here, but it is important. That
main speaker tonight, dear.
Well, this group of young people that were disturbed, and this teacher came into the room, and they were laughing and ridiculing and sort of jibing at each other and not ready to learn. And she said, if I didn't understand why you're acting as you do, I could hate every one of you. And one of them said, well, why are we acting as we do? She said, oh, you want me to get off the subject. But I'm not going to get off the subject. Unless you get your assignments, we won't talk about you and your problems. But if you do, we'll discuss it. Well, they hurried up with that assignment. She said, you don't want me to believe that you know how to learn. You want me to think you don't want to learn. But when in reality you're afraid you can't gain knowledge. And so you want to act like you disdain it. But she said, if you want to gain confidence in yourself, you have to have a skill. You have to know how to do something well. Then you become filled with the aura of becoming. And you want to grow more. You want to become finer than you are in every area, and you develop and grow in every aspect of your nature. Well, she talked with them in such a way that she awakened something in them, and she said, each of you has a problem, or you wouldn't have reached this position where you want to, you want to rebel and you want to disrupt the classroom. And one by one, they started telling their problems. And she was able to help them because of her frankness and her understanding. Excellence in every way is a vital ingredient in your fulfilling yourself. And one of the great experiences I've had since my husband's been governor was being at University of Michigan when they were giving honorary degrees to two of the astronauts. One of them was Ted White. And I said to him, weren't you surprised when you were chosen as an astronaut? And he said, no, the only thing that surprised me was that I wasn't chosen first. Well, he didn't say it with egotism. He said, I didn't think anyone on earth was better prepared for my assignment than I was. I didn't think anyone had disciplined himself more completely than I had. Physically, he said, I could stay in that capsule inert for any number of hours or days. Emotionally, I could be shot out into space without having it bother me, and I could walk in weightlessness. Intellectually, I had prepared for any advent, any circumstance. And I knew that I could handle it. Imagine what that gave to a young man, the confidence that he had, that he knew he could handle that, one of the most difficult of all assignments, physically, emotionally, and mentally. Well, we can't all be the finest, but we can all be fine. We can all have confidence. The young people that performed for us tonight, it gives them confidence to know they can sit at the piano or play on an instrument or sing or whatever, and that they will be accepted. And this is one of the things that's important, that along with our own excellence, we are kind to others and help others grow and live. Because if we turn off personalities that are around us, we are not letting their light become part of our lives. We are turning off whatever they have, and they have gifts and ingredients that can enrich us and help us grow and develop. We're not only destroying them, but we're destroying our own capacity. You have an opportunity to study not only in the prescribed way, but to delve into other areas that are interesting to you. One life, you know, is all you have. What you do with it is going to determine the quality and the excellence and the importance of that life. The time of our bodies on this earth is the time from our birth to our death, but the importance is determined by our mind and heart and spirit. The excellence with which we attain our knowledge and then our motivation for using it. And this is why we've wept so over the assassination of those who have recently left our world. Because they had mind and heart and spirit. They were trying to do something for humanity, and they were doing it because they had prepared to help and to face the problems of our age. And I come to the emotional side. The third, you know, you're not balanced unless you realize that you're a human being that's tied together, that you're not in certain little compartments, that this isn't your intellectual, this isn't your physical, this isn't your emotional. It's all together, because your physical is going to affect what you do intellectually and emotionally. Your emotional self is going to affect what you do mentally and physically, and so on. Every aspect of you is tied, your mind to body, to feelings, to belief. And then to relate to the whole. All these things have to be one. And this is why it's so foolish to tell young people today, doesn't matter what you do in this area. Take a little drug here, have a little promiscuousness here and all this. This is in a compartment. It isn't. Every experience you have affects the whole, affects you. And so when you come to the emotional, the spiritual, the moral, whatever you want to call it, this too is a vital part of you. And every way that you respond to another is going to affect that emotional part of you. And I resent with all my heart those who try to tell you that there is a new morality today and that it frees you, makes you free. Because liberty cannot be equated with licentiousness. To have liberty, to be free, you have to apply laws to your life. You have to know how to discipline and restrain yourself. He that taketh, ruleth himself is greater than he that taketh a city. You have to know that human nature is the most important ingredient, and that this does not mean that you turn it into an animal, that you turn it into a screaming child, but that you become disciplined, you have judgments and rules for yourself. I heard John Glenn when he said, you can have the most beautiful machine in the world, the fastest engine, the most dramatic and dynamic engine too, but if the plane isn't given direction, it doesn't mean a thing. And this is the way it is with your lives. If you don't have direction, if you don't have rules and goals and guidelines, all these other ingredients that you have are not going to mean much. You take a person like Marilyn Monroe. It seemed that she had everything. She had beauty, she had money, she had prestige. She was popular. She was a sex symbol when that was the most important thing to be, but she was a suicide. So people too have thought that all they needed was enough comfort, enough pleasure, enough money and so on, and prestige, and they would be happy, and they found that isn't true, and nations have found it isn't true, that you have to have something else, and that's the inner core of you. That's what you are. And your relationships with other human beings are either on a quality basis, or they are on a degenerative basis that destroy both of you. And those who tell you there's a new morality are are really telling you a falsehood, because what they call new is the old barnyard morality that's as old as the hills, and it's destroyed one civilization after another. Read about Rome. See what's so new. Read about the fall in the Old Testament of Sodom and Gomorrah. The inhabitants became so wicked and so promiscuous that they were destroyed. This isn't new. It would be new if we had a faithful generation, if they believed in the promises they made at the altar, forsaking all others. And I think your generation is capable of living up to something very fine and new. And I think the rebellion has come partly because our generation has let you down in so many aspects. You see us voicing the need for honesty, for faithfulness, for brotherhood, and not making a concrete example that we can follow our own principles. But don't give up the principles because some of the people have not adhered to them. And make, if you can, your examples those that do, and there are plenty that do. Of course you can find those that to disdain about you, and of course you can point a finger, but look for the others, they're all around you. Look for those who would sacrifice and help. And when I say sacrifice, I don't really mean that, because we're in a stream of giving. And if we're not giving, then we're not part of living. Eric Fromm said, giving is never a sacrifice. It's an overflowing of your aliveness, of everything that's beautiful within you, your strength, your joy, everything that's great. And when you overflow with that, you make others happy. So as you think about your emotional selves, know that there is a supreme authority. Anything else backs down when you get into a corner. If you have prestige because of wealth, it can be lost, as you know. Or because of sex or prestige, it means nothing in times of great distress. But if you have a bulwark of belief, if you have a foundation on an authority that is always there, you have a refuge, no matter what the situation. You have a strength that is greater than yourself. And I have heard people who are not religious experts. I have heard statesmen like Charles Malik, who was president of the United Nations, an Arab who became a Christian. And he said, we cannot lift ourselves. It's impossible. We have to have outside inspiration and guidance. And he said, if we'll just admit this, then in his name and for his sake, we do what we do. If we could believe this, we would have no problems overcoming communism. We wouldn't have any trouble showing the world that democracy works. It would work if we believed in these principles. What a tragedy, and I'm going to get off the subject for a minute, but I'll come back, that in Panama, for instance, we had the great know-how, the technological strength, the energy to build the locks there of the great Panama Canal. But what a tragedy that with all that knowledge, we didn't have the wisdom and the grace to help that nation become part of our concern. We built a barrier between the two. The Americans sat on their side, the Panamanians on the other side. And they hate us because we have not shared our ideas, our brotherhood, our constructive lives with theirs, our spirituality. And so we're at cross points now. They don't want us there. They don't want us to have a slice of their country. Even though we put all that money and construction into it, and we won't come out because we say we have too great a material investment. What about our social and human investment? Couldn't we have made a great contribution there if they loved us now as Americans and wanted to be part of our society as far as democracy is concerned, if that was their way of life, because we had shown them that it was one of brotherhood? I was in Japan when the same thing was evident. A group of people in the Air Corps, the wives, had never been outside of their own little air base there in the midst of Tokyo. They didn't know anything about the culture of Japan. They didn't know anything of the beauties of Japan. They kept a little wall, you might say, around them. And the people around them disliked them, and they disliked the people that lived in Tokyo. And I said to them, haven't you been to the shrines? Haven't you been to their schools? Haven't you conversed? No, we don't like anything Japanese. Well, how do you know? We who need the strength and the friendship and the love of the peoples of the earth and need them to know about democracy are not communicating it with them. And we're not communicating it in our own homes and communities. And this is why the emotional part is so important. That we become fine, that we're not just symbols of sex and liquor and big cars, as some of our of those who travel around tell us that we are the symbol of just those things. Let them know that our true symbol is that of commitment and judgment and brotherhood and understanding and quality and excellence. Let us get some new values and let people know what our values are. What are they? For young people today, I believe they're not a split-level home and three cars in the garage and a trip to Europe. I believe they are a world committed to peace and to brotherhood and to understanding. I think they are committed to the next generation. You, as you come up, will find that the greatest joy you have is in seeing that your children are fine and a blessing to others, and that they become the greatest value in your lives, and that you now are our great value and blessing. What are our values? What are our goals? What do we want the technological expertise that we have to end up in? What are the means that these means that we have should have a great goal in mind? And it can be there because, as has been said, we started this nation thinking we were creating a new order for the ages. And it's here. As I said, we almost have reached it. You remember Dickens said in his lines concerning the Tale of Two Cities, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the epoch of hope, it was the epoch of despair. It was the time of belief, and it was the time of unfaithfulness. And he goes on to describe how these two lived side by side in that great city. And that's our generation. Never has there been better times in some areas, and never have there been worse times in others. And where are the important differences? Materially, economically, we may be soaring with our expertise and our technological prowess, but when it comes to the quality of our own lives, when it comes to moral suffering, when it comes to delinquency, unwed mothers, divorces, crime, when it comes to violence, then we know that we have to do something about our country. And where does it start? It starts with you and me. It has to start in our own lives. And if we are incapable of creating violence, then we are a blessing. If our hearts are so softened that we cannot damage or hurt another, then our emotional strength is indeed a bulwark. And this, I think, is the thing you and I are striving for, that we are incapable of inflicting damage to another's personality, physically or emotionally, or even intellectually. That each person is in our orbit, and that we have to relate to the whole, one to another, and that we can only do it as we ourselves are humanized, are unselfish, are intellectually capable of being of service, are physically strong enough to endure the hardships of serving and helping. And so, it's a wonderful age. It means that you and I can help one another in a way that has never been possible before. And let me say to you, girls and boys, there is no more magnificent human relationship than that of marriage. Manhood and womanhood, one fulfilling it for the other. Don't destroy it and waste it on something less than the finest. This relationship is so magnificent that I resent those who would tell you that to be free is to be promiscuous. Love is the same as it always was, one alone and always. I have a 21-year-old who's in love. I know the way the language is still the same. I know that you don't want your partner out with somebody else. I know that you expect loyalty and completeness. There's no woman on earth that's happy if her husband isn't loyal to her. One of the greatest blessings she can have is to know she has devotion and that she can count on him wherever she is. And it's true, a man with his wife. If you don't have this, what do you have for your base? And you have to have a base if you're going to grow and get any place. And so for this base, you have to have these fine relationships. And to tell you otherwise is selling you down the river, because you can't have happiness without it. And that's why I resent those who would put themselves up as authority to tell you that you can have fine lives and fine relationships and good homes without faithfulness and without integrity and without beauty and without commitment, because you can't, any more than you can get an education without studying, and any more than you can get prestige without brotherhood. You can't do it. There are certain basic principles that are there, and you have to adhere to them or you don't get the results. And so in conclusion, let me just say that the world is looking to America for fulfillment, as I mentioned with Father Bruckberger's words. The world is looking to us for hope because there's no other nation on earth that's premised with the idea that we have been given our rights and privileges by a creator, not by the Democrats or the Republicans. This is the bulwark and the foundation of our nation, and therefore our strength. And if we forget this as a nation, and if we feel that it's only our own physical prowess or our increase in production per annum or our whirling men into space, our scientific progress or our military strength, we will all go down the drain, because there is no society that can thrive unless it has moral commitments and moral standards. And so as we think about this, it becomes very important to each of us, because how our nation goes, we all go. You and I can't be saved if everyone else is not. And each group is now entwined. We're not only integrated black and white, but we must be integrated with a higher being, with one another, with our finer selves, with art and literature and music, with all the great things that are ours. So it is a wonderful age, because we can be pertinent. Each one of us either lifts society or debases it. And there's no such thing as saying, but what I do, or this thing as they call it, is my own. It isn't. What you are and what you do has repercussions not only in your home and those who love you and in your immediate circle, but on society and the children you bear or don't bear and the educational processes and the taxes and the schools, everything in your community. How the people down the street act and live either hurts or enriches me and my family, and so it is with each of us. And so I say to you that this is an age of hope. And as we take the two side by side, whether it's one of fulfillment or despair, it can be fulfillment. And I believe it will be, because I believe in the younger generation. I think that you have the strength and the know-how and the idealism to lift us out of the declining morals and morass, you might say, and to keep us from going back and into the road of tyranny and violence. Because we can see that we have the base. We can reach into the finest in our traditions and our lives to give us the base that will bring back the American dream and bring the fulfillment and hope that will not only enrich the whole world, but will make you and your dear ones happy. Thank you very much.
It is our high privilege to have with us tonight the dynamic governor from the dynamic state of Michigan, the Honorable George Romney. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate that dynamic introduction by the dynamic sheriff from Bessemer. And I'm pleased to be here tonight and to have had a chance to hear my wife again. I usually avoid meetings where she's going to talk first, because that puts me in a tough spot. I've been dating her and pursuing her since she was 15 and I was 17, so I've known her quite a while. And by the time I met her, she could talk. As a matter of fact, she'd been participating in dramatics and public speaking and giving readings from the time she was 3 years of age. And when I first saw her, I said, there's the girl for me. It took me 7 years to get her to say yes, but I was persistent. And when I went east to go to college in Washington, D.C., with the idea of going on to Harvard Business Administration School, because I had no connections to speak of in the country, none in the East, and I was ambitious. I had some goals, And I thought that if I could graduate from the Harvard Business School with honors or a good record, at least, that I might find an opportunity. That was the way you found an opportunity in those days, if you didn't have any background in the areas you were interested in the industrial world. Well, I was sufficiently interested in her, so I even gave up that, see, and decided she was more important than getting that college degree. And then she had a tough decision to make, because when I was making $125 a month, she had to decide whether to sign a contract that would give her $50,000 a year or take me. Now, maybe she made a mistake. She'll have to answer that. I know I didn't. And there is nothing more important in life than finding the person that's meant for you and keeping yourself for that person. Now, human nature hasn't really changed down through the centuries. If you go back and read history, and I know that girls don't want boys who cheapen themselves and don't think themselves important. And boys don't want girls who sell themselves cheap. And there's nothing more important in life, as I say, than finding a companion that you can be happy with. And then devoting yourselves completely to each other. Now, I want to congratulate you for being here on this campus this week to help clear the atmosphere. I guess Boy State had a little competition. And I'm glad they were here too. And I'm glad you're following up, because I think you are in marked contrast to that SDS group. And we need that contrast. You don't get the publicity, but fortunately, there are a lot more of you than there are of them. In my book, they're learned know-nothings. They have a good deal of book knowledge, but they don't really understand things. They don't really know what America is all about. Because the hard facts are that the United States of America is the highest expression as a country that the world has ever seen. There's never been a society equal to the American society. And they don't realize that. They know America isn't perfect, and America isn't perfect. But America has come closer to the goals that mankind has been yearning for through the ages than any other nation the world has ever seen. And America is the finest expression to date of the Judeo-Christian principles and the Greek philosophy. The principles of government as developed by Rome and by Britain and the founders of this nation in shaping it drew on all of those sources, all of the wisdom of the ages in creating this great country. And then they did something else. They recognized that man's knowledge alone is not enough. They recognized that they needed guidance and inspiration, and they sought it. And I believe, without reservation, what Washington said and what Lincoln said and others, namely, that the principal thing that brought this nation into being was the hand of providence. After all, the people that first came here, many of them came searching the right to worship God according to the dictates of their own conscience. They wanted freedom of worship, freedom of belief. And this began to build the foundation for this country. The idea that every individual should have the right to worship God according to his own concepts. And so this religious foundation was established before the nation itself was created. And those men who wrote the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States, they did something unique in history, never been done before. As they protested what they felt was the tyranny and oppression of Great Britain, and as they decided to revolt, they felt that they had to do more than just point out what they didn't like. They felt they had to point out the principles that justified their doing what they were going to do. And so they wrote a perfectly unique document in world history, the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence is a document that contains eternal and universal principles of self-government. Principles that define more accurately and more completely than any other document you will find the relationship between God, man, and government. And the most important single idea embodied in that document is that we are children of a Creator who has endowed us with inalienable rights. This is the most important idea in the Declaration of Independence and in the whole American society. The fact that we have the right to govern ourselves, self-government, government by consent, from our Creator, not from other man, not from government, but from our Creator. Now, on that basis, they proceeded to fashion a form of government to enable us to have the maximum opportunity to develop our own talents and our own abilities in the ways that we think will enable us to best meet our own goals and be of service to others. And one of the things, another thing they recognized is this, and this is a very fundamental idea, and that is that no one is perfect. And nothing human is perfect. Everything we have to deal with in life is imperfect, except those principles of truth that have been revealed or discovered. But human beings are imperfect. And in our actions, none of us are perfect. And recognizing this, they decided that the power of government should not be so concentrated that any imperfect human being could exercise too much power. They decided that we'd make more progress in this country if instead of making the government all-powerful, they made the people all-powerful. And so they vested ultimate power in the hands of the people. And to ensure this, they created a form of government under the Constitution of the United States that divides governmental power. Not only makes the government subject to the consent of the people, but also divides the power. And that's because whenever you get an imperfect person exercising too much power, millions in a large nation pay for it and suffer from it. And so they divided governmental powers between the three branches of the federal government, between the federal and the state government. And of course, we have the three branches in the state government. And then they made the people and their private institutions the most important aspect of American life, more important than government. Now, we're losing sight of that for many reasons, principally because of our success, in my opinion. The very magnitude of our success. Not that our success has been all it should be, because certainly our principles have only been partially applied. The best evidence of this is the relationship between races and the extent to which people have been denied full citizenship on the basis of mere color and race. But nevertheless, the magnitude of our success has exceeded that of any nation in history. And the very magnitude of our success, particularly as it's been reflected in a material way, has created a society of such abundance and wealth that you don't have to work as hard as we had to. And this makes it tougher for you than it did for us. People develop capacity and strength by effort. If you take a look at wealthy families, there are very few children of wealthy families who really develop their talents very fully. A few. The Rockefellers and the Kennedys are outstanding in that respect. They're not typical. They're exceptions. And primarily because in those instances, their parents established goals and requirements that compelled the children to continue to struggle even in the midst of great wealth and to develop their capacities. But that isn't true generally of the American society. One of the greatest challenges you face is to not lose character, capacity, and the willingness to serve in the midst of all this abundance. I haven't any question but that many of the SDS young people who were here last week are young people from affluent, well-to-do families. I haven't any question but that they're somewhat like the hippies that my wife and I saw in Haight-Ashbury Park last September. We went to hippie land. We met the digger. The digger's the one that dug up the money to enable them all to eat and to get by without having to work very hard. And we met him. We talked with him. He took us down to Haight-Ashbury Park. And we met with him as we got out of his truck. One of them handed me a half a chicken. And I broke it in half and gave half back to him. Somebody else handed me a roll, and I broke that in half, and then about that time somebody handed me a marijuana cigarette. But in any event, I haven't any question, but these young people who are here are like the young people who are out there. Many of them from families who were so preoccupied in having a good time and enjoying life in a material way that they weren't listening to their own children. They weren't communicating with their own children. They weren't disciplining their own children. They weren't imparting standards to their own children. And as a result, many are alienated and lack any understanding of what this American society is all about. Now, this American society excels in its foundation, which is belief in a creator. That's the foundation of America. It excels in its political structure, its governmental structure, in the distribution of power and the opportunity that we have as individual citizens to be effective in a political and governmental manner to the extent of our willingness to involve ourselves and the extent of our abilities and our capacities. There's no restriction there other than our own willingness to commit ourselves and our own willingness to involve ourselves and our own abilities and capacities. And then we have developed unique social institutions and we have developed unique economic institutions. Two of the most unique social concepts we've developed are universal free education and equal educational opportunity. We haven't realized them fully, but no other nation in history has ever established those goals and objectives and striven for them as we have striven for them. In the economic field, I've spent most of my life in business and industry. The American economy is unique. The American economy is not primarily a capitalistic economy. Capitalism is one of its distinctive characteristics. Private ownership of property. But that's not its most distinctive characteristic. The American economy is not like the capitalistic economies of Western Europe. The capitalists are not the bosses of the American economy. The bosses of the American economy are the people, as consumers in a free market. We were going down the traditional capitalistic road in the last century when we had the robber barons and the trusts and the monopolies. And then the people, through their representatives, did something unique in history. They wrote a body of economic laws called the antitrust laws that in effect say, if you're going to build automobiles, you've got to build automobiles in competition with other companies building automobiles so people can have a choice. If you're going to sell groceries, you've got to sell groceries in competition with other people who are selling groceries so people can have a choice. And people can decide whether they want to buy your groceries or somebody else's groceries, or whether they want to buy your automobiles or somebody else's automobiles. Now, the minute we did that, we put the power of making the ultimate economic decisions in this country in the hands of the people, in essentially the same way as the founders put ultimate political power in the hands of the people by saying that the people who were going to govern us were going to be selected by the people going and voting for them in ballot booths. In the economy, we said we're going to reward those companies that people, where people decide to buy their products or buy their services in a free market, in an open market, in open competition. And that put this economy basically in the hands of the people. Now, that's being threatened too. Primarily because we have permitted great excesses of private power to build up in our desire to overcome what was a big injustice in the relationship between the power of business and the power of labor. And in order to correct that imbalance, we wrote labor laws that are in complete conflict with the antitrust laws. They promote monopoly in the collective bargaining field, both on the part of employers and unions, whereas the earlier laws, the basic development of our economy was on a competitive basis. And there are only two ways to discipline an economy. Only two. One's competition, and the other's absolute authority. And in this country, if we move to absolute authority, and we're in between now, we haven't decided which way we're going. We're going to decide in your lifetime whether we're going to continue to discipline the American economy on the basis of competition, where the people will make the decisions, the basic economic decisions, or whether we'll have some form of state-controlled and directed economy. And I hope we'll be wise enough to make the right decision. But we have a unique economic system as a result of these basic concepts. And they all go back. They all go back to this basic idea that that human beings are not just animals, that they are children of a creator. That's the central idea. And one of the great things to be concerned about in this country is the extent to which faith in that idea has tended to weaken in recent years. And also with that weakening, a weakening in an understanding and an acceptance of our superior American institutions. Because these young people who were on the campus last week, they want to destroy all this. They want to destroy America. They say it's all wrong. Now, they don't know what they want to put in place. But they just want to tear it down. They want to tear down the finest society the world has yet seen. And you know, that's entirely possible for them to do. It doesn't take many people to either tear down or build up in a free society. Only a minority. Only a committed, dedicated minority. It only took one man in the days of King David, who was probably the finest king Israel ever had, to create a revolution in Israel. And the one who did it was King David's own son, a boy by the name of Absalom. And Absalom defiled his own sister and killed his own brother and fled the kingdom. And his father finally forgave him and permitted him to come back into Israel. And he began to stand outside of his father's court, and as his father would make decisions, judgments, as the people would come out, he would say to those who lost, "If I were a king, you would get justice." He didn't tell them how. He just said, in effect, "Look, you didn't get justice, and if you support me, I'll get you justice." And pretty soon he had half the nation with him. And he set out to take over the kingdom and to kill his own father. And when they went into battle, his father said to his troops, "Do anything you have to, but spare my son Absalom. Do not kill Absalom." Now that was the difference between the two men. And Absalom's like the hippies. He had long hair. And he was riding in the battle, and he went under some trees, and his hair was flying. He was and got caught in the branches. And he hung there and was killed that way. It's easy to tear down. Before you permit anybody to tear down this great nation and its institutions, you ask them to tell you of something better. Based on the hard realities that we are not perfect. None of us are perfect. And therefore we need a society where each of us will have maximum opportunity to develop our talents and our abilities in the way we feel we can best develop them, as long as we don't impair others. Helen Keller died last week. A week before last, I guess it was. Up to the age of 8, as a result of not being able to hear or see, she was a little animal. They finally secured Ann Sullivan to come and work with her, to try and do something with her. And Ann Sullivan literally had to get down and fight with her on the floor to make her obey. Because the first step in human progress is obedience. Obedience to law. And the laws of God, the Ten Commandments, the Sermon on the Mount, are just as valid today as they were when they were revealed. We can't break them, but they can break us. They are eternal and immutable. Obedience, obedience to God's laws and man's laws, is the way to human progress and personal growth and development. And for you to be able to realize your fullest potentials, you need to acquire a full understanding of how distinct and unusual this great country is. And then to be able, in the right spirit, to share our concepts and our principles with others through persuasion and through example. And let me close by citing the words of Rabbi Morris Adler. Rabbi Morris Adler was that great Jewish rabbi, one of the greatest in the nation, who was shot in his own synagogue down in Detroit a little over 2 years ago by a young man he was trying to help. He was assassinated in his own synagogue. And he told of his father's, at one time, of his father's words at the time he was naturalized. He was brought from Russia by his father to flee the communists. And the day his father was made an American citizen, his father said in substance to the children, "May we so live and act that other people will think of our nation not as the mightiest, that is not important, but as the freest, not as the wealthiest, that is not important, but as the most humane and generous, and not as the leader of the world, that is not important, but as the servant of humanity and the steward of the liberties of people everywhere. As my wife has said, you're living in a thrilling age. This is the greatest age the world's ever seen. Your opportunities are greater than any those of any young people in history. There is a frontier of global opportunity to serve mankind awaiting you, and the other peoples of the earth are yearning for what we have in this country. And one of the greatest challenges is to find the ways in which we can help them and help those in this country, because we have millions in this country not fully participating in it with equal opportunity, equal justice. To find ways to enable that at home and abroad is the great challenge before you. Thank you very much. Look, we'd be glad to answer questions in a few minutes if you want to ask questions. You can ask them of either one of us.
Governor, do you anticipate the same bubble in Detroit that happened last year? And also, are you considering
running
as a vice presidential candidate if he's behind Rockefeller or Nixon?
Well, those are two unrelated subjects, but... well, number one, I'm not running for the vice presidency with Governor Rockefeller or with Vice President Nixon. I'm not seeking the office, and I don't know what I would do if I was confronted with the question of whether or not I would accept the nomination. I literally don't know what I'd do. It's going to depend on whether or not I think I can make the greatest contribution one way or another if I should ever be confronted with that. I don't expect to be confronted with it either. But in any event, I'm not seeking it. And I'm not doing anything in that connection. My primary concern on the national level at the present time is to make certain that as a Michigan delegation, we do what we can to provide this nation the best leadership choice this fall that we can provide. And I'm going to do that without regard to what it may involve beyond that. I think that's so important at this time that has to have complete priority as far as I'm concerned. Now, with respect to Detroit, I don't think anyone can say with absolute certainty what's going to happen in Detroit or any other major city this summer or next summer. I do know that we have taken many steps so that there should be less likelihood of difficulty. Number one, we have passed many laws to eliminate some of the injustice that we had a year ago. Importantly, in the housing field, the Fair Housing Bill, the Tenants' Rights Bill, the Building Code legislation, and other legislation in that area. We've also taken steps to be able to act more effectively with respect to disorderly conduct, riots, demonstrations, etc. I think another factor in the situation is that the federal government is clear on how it's going to act. It wasn't last summer. When we first asked for their help last summer, when I first requested it from Attorney General Clark and he requested from the White House, I was told that all that they needed was an oral request. And we made that oral request. And then they came back and wanted a written request, and they wanted certain certifications and all this other stuff. Things I couldn't certify to because I didn't know whether they existed or not. Well, since then, the Attorney General and the President have decided that all they need is an oral request. And we could have had the troops in Detroit 18 hours earlier than we had them if it hadn't been for that uncertainty in their mind last year. Now, that's cleared up. Another factor last summer was that the mayor of Detroit decided he had everything under control up until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He kept telling us he had it under control. The state had no intelligence in Detroit. We were dependent upon Detroit to keep us accurately informed. We kept contacting them because we thought it was out of control, but they kept telling us they had it under control. They didn't request our help until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We now have our own state police intelligence personnel in Detroit, so we know what's happening in Detroit just as we have it in all other parts of the state. That was the only place where we didn't have it last summer. So we're better prepared to deal with a situation. And I think another factor that's tremendously important is that the people who went through that horrible experience last summer don't want to have it repeated. There's more resistance to it. This was evident following the assassination of Reverend King this spring, when we had complete cooperation from most of the people in the Detroit area in dampening what could have gotten out of hand again. Now, on the other hand, let me be realistic about it and not ignore the fact that those who want to create revolution and who want to destroy are better organized too. It's a small group of blacks and a small group of whites, importantly. In both cases, they're armed, they're organized, and they're trained. And they're enlisting recruits. Now, they're a small group. And I hope we'll be able to avoid difficulty.
What do you think will come out of these peace talks in Paris?
Well, I'm profoundly concerned about the situation. I'm concerned because there's nothing really tangible so far to indicate that the North Vietnamese intend to use them for the purposes of negotiating a political settlement at this time. I think the odds are that they're using them for other purposes. And that concerns me because I believe that if they should collapse, or if they should continue indefinitely, and if there weren't some results, that it could encourage two viewpoints in this country, both of which I think are wrong. One, a peace at any price viewpoint, and the other, one voiced by one of the national figures, let's go over and kick the devil out of them. In other words, the idea that we can settle that situation in Vietnam through an all-out military use of military force. I think both viewpoints are wrong. And I believe a failure in Paris could tend to encourage both viewpoints. So I'm concerned. Now, this young man had his head on.
As a person who has campaigned for the president, do you feel that in view of the fact that the political assassinations in recent times, that the campaigning for president itself is going to be completely changed?
No, I think you'll continue to have the person-to-person contact, and I don't think we can afford to conduct campaigns on any other basis. I think the people have the right, to the extent they want to and to the extent it's possible, to see the candidates physically and to look them in the eye and to meet them and to have personal contact. There is no substitute for that. Now, the electronic media is pretty effective in the press, but it really doesn't substitute completely for the other. And I don't think you'll see it eliminated.
There seems to be kind of an unwritten law in the Republican Party not to slam fellow candidates. What do you think the Republican Party's reaction will be to Governor Rockefeller's slam of Richard Nixon?
Well, you might get some argument if you had Rockefeller people here and Nixon people here as to whether he is or isn't. I think that the basic objective of the 11th commandment is sound, namely that political campaigns shouldn't be conducted on the basis of attacking others on the basis of personality or name-calling or anything of that character. I think at the same time it creates a rather difficult problem because you can't really have a meaningful campaign that doesn't bring out the differences between individuals on issues and their records and their background and their qualifications. And the result is that the minute you begin to discuss issues and you begin to point out differences between yourself and the other candidate on issues, some people will say, well, you're attacking him and breaking the 11th commandment. I had this happen to me in New Hampshire. Up to that point, Vice President Nixon had supported the president's Vietnam policy, basically, indicating he didn't think the president was aggressive enough militarily and so on. I mean, that was the basic thrust of his position. And he wouldn't debate me, and he won't debate Governor Rockefeller. No, this is a perfectly proper thing for him to decide as a part of campaign strategy. I wouldn't debate Zoltan Ferenczi either. Because no use providing audiences for your opposition, and you know, a lot of things to consider. But in any event, Nixon wouldn't debate me, and I was way behind in New Hampshire. So I had to establish some differences between Vice President Nixon and myself. And so I advanced a specific Vietnam program. And even if I do say so myself, I'm still the only national man who's been a national candidate who has presented a specific program on Vietnam. But after presenting a specific program on Vietnam, I then said that that Mr. Nixon's position was a Me Too position on Vietnam, that he was basically supporting the president's position, and he was. Now, I heard at that point from some of my most ardent supporters and prominent ones raising the question as to whether I was violating the 11th commandment. Well, was I or wasn't I? Now, I do know this, that what I said in New Hampshire had some impact on former Vice President Nixon's Vietnam position, because he loosened it up. And he put himself in a position where he can go in either direction at this time. Remember, he said, the only thing he's really said is that he'll bring peace to Southeast Asia and he'll put an end to the war. But he hasn't told us how. But he's loosened it up, you see. So that's a difficult thing. I hope I've been responsive to your question. It's a difficult thing to distinguish between something that is a personal attack that violates the 11th commandment and something that really is a legitimate discussion of the issues or the record of the candidates and so on. Where's the young lady? Yeah, there's one.
I think it's more important in our international policy with Vietnam, all this stuff, or our present policy in the United States.
Well, I can answer that one very simply. Weaknesses within are almost always more serious than weaknesses without. And that's true with nations, and it's true with individuals. And as President Eisenhower said to me several occasions, you can't afford to launch an offensive until you have a firm, impregnable base to operate from. Now, I think the weaknesses that threaten us within are more serious than the weaknesses that threaten us from without. Yes, sir.
Mr. Pender, kind of a touchy question. I'm wondering, you know, like last spring and stuff, in your campaign when you went to Vietnam, when the press reported some of the statements you made, I saw some of the news coverage, and it seemed to be rather slanderous. And you know,
I thought so, too. Well, I didn't consider it slanderous. Let me hasten to say, I didn't consider it slanderous, but it was not accurate. It was slanted, much of it.
Well, what, is there anything that can be done to correct this situation? I mean, it seems
not and have a free press. Well, I'll tell you. You might be interested in looking up an article by the National Observer a few days after I withdrew from the presidential race, in which one of the men who played a part in creating the public impression that existed that was not completely accurate wrote an article in which he said maybe they'd been wrong in what they'd been doing. And he also pointed out that 20 to 30 national correspondents in this country can take a certain viewpoint and pretty much condition public thinking through the country. And if those 20 or 30 take a basic position, why, watch out. So this is something to be concerned about too. On the other hand, you can't have a free press without letting it be free, as long as they don't go as far as they did with Senator Goldwater and say he was mentally incompetent. They got pretty close to that with me. They didn't quite say it. A little more subtle.
Right here.
Sir, what do you think of running to France's side all the time and helping her bolster her flank when she gives us so much trouble? And do you think we should recognize Red China?
Well, those are two nice little short questions. Well, they're good questions. They're good basic questions, of course. Fundamental. Well, first, let me say this with respect to Europe. I think we've made many mistakes with respect to Europe in the post-war period. I think that one of the most serious mistakes we made was in connection with NATO. And I can point it out best by reminding you of what we did with respect to the Marshall Plan. Now, the Marshall Plan was the plan used to help revive Europe economically. And I don't think there's anyone who questions but that we made a great contribution to Europe and world peace by what we did to help Europe economically when she was at the point where she was in danger of the communists taking over Europe because of economic distress. And at that point, we not only indicated we were willing to help them, but we said to the European nations, now we're not going to tell you what should be done. You've got to come up with a European plan for the economic revival of Europe. And they did. And then we took a look at their plan and we said, well, let's change this and that, but basically we'll go along with your plan. So it was their plan. It was a European plan for the economic revival of Europe. We didn't do that in the military area. We moved right into NATO. We developed the plans. We always had the American in command. So de Gaulle and others began to think that it was our plan, not their plan. And when President Kennedy met with Macmillan in Bermuda and entered into an agreement with respect to nuclear weapons and left France completely out, in my opinion, that was one of the decisive factors in our relationship with France and de Gaulle. Now, what I'm saying is I think we have made mistakes as well as the French. And I don't think it's a one-sided situation. And I think it's very urgent that we undertake to correct the mistakes we've made with respect to Europe and France and to get back on a good working relationship. Because believe you me, we need Europe with us, and we don't want them to join up with Russia and the communist world. Now, with respect to China, I don't think we can afford to just isolate a nation completely. I think we ought to do everything we can to break down barriers and to establish communication and to hopefully bring influences to bear on China to cause her to change her conduct and to qualify herself as a nation that can be admitted to the Council of Nations and the United Nations. And I think we should make it clear that we're prepared to do all we can in that direction. I think we're doing some things, but I think we could do more. And I think also that in connection with the Vietnamese situation, that instead of pursuing a course that drives China and Russia together in partnership with North Vietnam, we ought to take advantage of their separate interests over there and at least get one of them on our side.